Okay, welcome back. As I mentioned earlier, for those of you who are just joining us while you're meditating, welcome. And I am intending tonight to talk a little bit about a topic that's very dear to my heart, one that is the subject of a book that I wrote. It's the exploration of the Buddha's teachings on spiritual friendship and about how they might support us to build the kind of relationships that can transform our own minds and hearts and to transform our communities and to transform society in the most liberated way. And I felt drawn to these teachings for a lot of reasons. And one of them was a teaching that I had heard a few times that I liked and that also felt kind of mysterious. Maybe some of you have heard it. It comes from the Upada Sutta, which is found in the Samyutta Nikaya. It describes a conversation between the Buddha and his cousin Ananda. And in it, the Venerable Ananda makes this proposition to the Buddha. He says, Lord Buddha, I think that spiritual friendship, admirable companionship, good friendship is fully half of the holy life. And the Buddha says, no, no, Ananda, it's not just half, it's the whole of the holy life. Like, it's the whole thing. Have you guys heard that, some of you? Some yes, some yeah, some no. Yeah, that phrase caught my attention. I thought, what does this mean, the whole of the holy life? And so that teaching is kind of my way into this exploration today. I'd love to explore a few questions that I had about this teaching that led me to write a book about this teaching, and namely, how is it that friendship can be a spiritual practice? How is spiritual practice also political practice? And what does it mean to lead a holy life? So, in terms of friendship as a spiritual practice, I think of spiritual friendship and the phrase that the Buddha used in this text, it's called Kalyanamitta in Pali. It's a relationship between two or more people who are committed to their own liberation and to each other's liberation. And liberation, of course, is the point of any of our mindfulness practices. It's to become free, and that stress reduction is important, and it's a kind of liberation in its own right, and it's wonderful to be aware and to be present and to be mindful. And the Buddha taught that we can be even more than that, we can be actually completely liberated. And he described liberation as the complete extinguishing of greed and hatred and delusion that cloud the mind. These are called the three poisons. They cloud the mind, they obscure the true nature of the mind and heart. And we often think about them as, how we experience them in our individual mind. We can feel the kind of grasping nature of greed or the pushing away of hatred or aversion or the kind of tuning out of delusion or ignorance, and we can see these states kind of come and go like clouds in the mind as we meditate. And frankly, when greed and hatred and delusion are present, they poison our relationships too. It's not just our own mind. So they can cause us to objectify one another. They can cause us to feel separate from one another. They can cause us to ignore each other. So that when these obstructions are present in the mind, it's not only we that suffer, but we also create the conditions for suffering in each other. And so when the Buddha taught that friendship is the whole of the holy life, I think he meant that in friendship, we can start to stabilize some of the qualities that we develop in meditation, mindfulness, compassion. so that through our relationships, they can start to permeate all the other waking hours of our life. And that also in relationship, we start to see the ways in which we cling. The way that we may at times react to getting what we don't want or not wanting what we have. And that those experiences can illuminate for us the places where we still have room to grow. So liberation from suffering is the point. And in that liberation from suffering, we start to become free to express our true nature. The idea is that when these poisons are liberated, that all that's left is the true nature of the heart, which is luminosity and love. And that that path is not an individual pursuit, but it's a relational pursuit. So the book that I wrote is structured around another teaching on friendship called the Metta Sutta, and it's one in which the Buddha describes seven qualities of a true spiritual friend, this person who shows up for their own and for our liberation too. And the Buddha said that the qualities of this friend are that they give what is hard to give, they do what is hard to do, that they endure what is hard to endure, they tell you their secrets, they keep your secrets, that when misfortune strikes, they don't abandon you, and that when you're down and out, they don't look down on you. So the Buddha said that a person who has these seven qualities is someone really worth associating with. So it's someone we'd like to be, but also when we find a person like this in our lives, that they're a person to learn from. And so I feel like this description of the friend is, you know, it's, I mean, this may be stating the obvious, but it's not saying someone who is like always really, really nice or like, you know, has no boundaries and let us act however we want, never says anything, you know, like it's a rigorous path. It's a principled path. It involves the practice of generosity, of wise effort, of patience and forbearance, of honesty, compassionate listening, loyalty, respect, and that while rigorous, it can be a joyful effort, and that there's something about this structure and scaffolding of values and principles that actually allows for ease and flow and play to be possible in relationships. So it's the kind of strong container that allows for an ease and relaxation, and that feeling of connection, that feeling of safety with one another, is something that we can build, and we can. I almost want to say we earn it. You know, we earn it by working in this way. And so I believe that the Buddha is encouraging us to pull relationships into what we think of as the frame or the sphere of our spiritual life, that oftentimes we might keep our spiritual life compartmentalized for a variety of reasons. Maybe it doesn't feel safe to share, you know, that we are practicing in a particular way or meditating, or, you know, we feel like people won't understand. So, you know, we meditate, we maybe go to a, you know, teaching, a retreat, but we don't really keep those practices and those experiences top of mind in other parts of our life. No blame, no shade. This is just one of the things that happens. Sometimes there can be a swing the other way where we may feel that, you know, out of the exuberance of finding something that works really well for us, we feel like, man, this, I could really practice this in my relationships if only everyone else would also meditate and go on retreats and do the things that I do. And so there's this tendency sometimes to get preachy and try to convert others and feel like I could really have a spiritual friend if only I had someone who did the exact same spiritual practice as me. I think it was Jack who said, "My family hates it when I'm a Buddhist, but loves it when I'm a Buddha." You know, this sense of like, telling people about friendship or telling people about the practice that we're doing isn't necessarily the way. And as ever with the Dharma, there's this invitation into a third way, this kind of middle way between extremes. So that it's possible to practice being a true friend without even announcing it, even when it's difficult, and to learn from other people who embody these principles. And that those people may or may not be mindfulness practitioners or Buddhists. So in terms of practicing this teaching, you know, it's possible to take the sutta as a whole, but I really like to think about practicing with one of those characteristics at a time to see if it's possible to develop them, to develop it more, and to use one of them as my North Star as I'm navigating experience. So that working with, for example, that first principle of giving what is hard to give, if I'm working on developing my practice of spiritual friendship as a way to move towards liberation, I can, in moments of uncertainty or feeling grabbed or feeling kind of swayed by life or feeling shaky, I might reflect on the question, is there anything I can give now to be a better friend? Or something like, what is the most generous next move I can make? So they start to be companions or compasses as we navigate our day-to-day experience. And I want to talk about a little bit about how friendship can be a political practice. And for this, I really want to shout out my friends and I would say teachers at Buddhist Peace Fellowship, where I really feel like I started to understand the value of knowing and allowing the spiritual and political practices to really inform one another and in some cases to merge. So, in partnership with Don Haney, Katie Locke, Lietzen Wong, really, I think articulating beautifully these the possibility of a spiritual and political practice. And I was recently nerding out a bit and rereading a text by Hannah Arendt. It's Origins of Totalitarianism, just like some light summer reading. And in the last chapter, she talks about isolation and loneliness and the way that, fostering that systems of oppression can foster separation in a way that makes us easier to control politically. She writes this: terror can rule absolutely only over men who are isolated against each other. Therefore, one of the primary concerns of all tyrannical government is to bring this isolation about. Isolation may be the beginning of terror. It is certainly its most fertile ground. And it is always its result. This isolation is, as it were, pre-totalitarian. Its hallmark is impotence, insofar as power always comes from men acting together. Isolated men are powerless by definition. So here she's talking about the rise of anti-Semitism and fascism in Europe. In the 50s, she's writing about this. Reflecting on the horrors of the previous decade. But certainly these kind of totalitarian regimes, fascist regimes, they erode relationships across differences. And they even erode relationships with people we think of as like us. And they even erode our relationship with ourselves. They benefit when we are kept busy judging ourselves and trying to fix ourselves and ashamed of ourselves and trying to cover that up. And so when we look again at the Mita Sutta, we can see that to be a true friend in the way that the Buddha described can indeed be a radical political act. That when we think about giving what is hard to give and generosity, you know, how radical is it to give not just our resources, to kind of question what we think of as ours and to give directly to the people and causes we care about, but also to give our time to what we feel is really important. To give space, to reclaim our attention and give it where we feel like it really matters. Or the second principle of doing what is hard to do, the wise effort. Like, how radical is it in a culture that tells us the only things that are worth working for are material, to exert our energy to enlarging our spiritual condition and enriching our non-transactional relationships? This third principle the Buddha describes of enduring what is hard to endure, you know, how might we transform the places of fragility within us into stability so that we can be more reliable to our friends and not so reactive and defensive? And that this principle of telling our secrets, you know, they're not just you know, telling each other kind of salacious details about our lives. But I think in this political way, telling secrets means exposing societal truths about things that need to change. And that honesty and that vulnerability and not hiding our true experience from one another can also be an act of friendship. The next principle the Buddha says, that spiritual friend is one who keeps your secrets, that we can become more trustworthy in such a way that we can receive the truths of each other's lives with tenderness and with respect. This principle that when misfortune strikes, the friend won't abandon you. I think of this as loyalty, and often, you know, use the kind of meditation training that I offer today as a training ground for that quality, like not abandoning each other, the quality of staying with, and also not abandoning ourselves in the process. And this last principle, you know, that when the spiritual friend is down, when you're down and out, the spiritual friend won't look down on you. The ability to exist really in deep equity with one another. So I think there is a friendship practice that can both help us to resist systems of oppression, to resist fascism, and also to embody freedom in our societies as well as in our souls. I was delighted to discover this passage from a book called Joyful Militancy. It's by Carla Bergman and Nick Montgomery. And they say this, freedom and friend share the same early Indo-European root, fri or pri, meaning love. This root made its way into Gothic, Norse, Celtic, Hindi, Russian, and German. To be quote unquote free was not to be unrestricted, but to be a friend among loved ones. As the Invisible Committee writes in To Our Friends, friend and free in English come from the same Indo-European root, which conveys the idea of a shared power that grows. Being free and having ties was one and the same thing. I am free because I have ties, because I am linked to a reality that is greater than me. And so I think it brings us back, you know, around to what is it that we mean by freedom? What is it we mean by liberation? What does it mean to live a holy life? And that we're not talking about the kind of freedom that I get to do whatever I want, whenever I want to act out of kind of selfish self-interest, but it's the freedom that comes from knowing that there's not a chance in the universe that I'm ever not connected. That I can't actually be alone. That as Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. described, that we are all woven into this inescapable web of mutuality from which we cannot fall. And the more and more we can bring that into consciousness and awareness and our felt experience, the freer we will be. And so I hope to just encourage this consideration of liberation as a relational endeavor, as a collective endeavor, as a way to resist commodification, as a reminded of a passage by the great civil rights leader, Grace Lee Boggs, who said, "These are the times to grow our souls. Each of us is called upon to embrace the conviction that despite the powers and principalities bent on commodifying all our human relationships, we have the power within us to create the world anew." And I would say we have the power between us to create the world anew. And so, if there's anything I could encourage you with as I, you know, just close these reflections, I hope that you take a fresh look at your friendships as a site of practice. To think of them not as a garnish, not as a side dish, but as the juicy main course of your spiritual life. And what I wish for you is that the richness of that exploration help spread your practice across all areas of your life. That the principles of spiritual friendship need not even be limited to the people that we think of as quote unquote friends. But I didn't think I was going to share this, but one time I was on retreat at a center where I was just pretty lonely. I was on a solo retreat for quite a while, and I was missing people. And one day I was taking a walk near the center, and I saw Sharon Salzberg, who's a Buddhist meditation teacher. Some of you may know she is one of the founders of Insight Meditation Society. Happened to be taking a walk right down the road. I could not believe my eyes. And I was supposed to be on silent retreat, but I totally stopped to talk to her. I was like, "Sharon," I hugged her. I was like, "I'm so lonely. I'm sad. Why do we do this practice this way? This is terrible." And she hugged me and she laughed and she said, "Oh, I have a few friends. I have a few friends here on retreat." And my first thought was, "Oh my gosh, Sharon Salzberg thinks I'm her friend." You know, I was like, "Wow, this is amazing." And then I was like, "Wow, Sharon Salzberg thinks everyone's her friend." Because she has that lifelong practice. You know, that's what a life of practicing metta will do. And I will say that I don't feel that way all the time, but I've had glimpses of that. You know, of working with cultivating loving kindness, of working with these characteristics of friendship, and looking around a room of strangers and feeling safe. And I also have been inspired by an elder in our lineage, Eric Kolvig, who was one of the founders of the LGBTQIA retreats, as we now call them. And I got to learn from him in my training. He said something that just moved me. He said that, you know, someone was asking him what his practice is now after decades and decades and decades, and he's had some, you know, is experiencing an aging body and aging mind. And he stopped and he said, I just try to relate to each and every being I meet as a personal friend. And if you ever met him, you could see that he really does this. You know, every rock, every puppy, every cranky, you know, neighbor, personal friend. So I kind of wish that for all of us, the beauty of a life like that and the power that that creates. We need that kind of power now. So I think it would be a good time for me to close now. Very sleepy, but it's also kind of been fun to like stay up late with you guys. Stay up late talking about the Dharma. Yeah, I wish you well. I hope our paths cross again sometime. And sending a lot of love to each of you and to your people. Stay together in these times.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.